Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome back to the Early Morning Sunday Show with me, Anisa Isak, and we are at the slot called the Conscious Consumer with Mufti Muhammad Hafiji from the Economics and Finance Desk of the Jamiatul Ulama South Africa. Mufti, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, Anisa and all our listeners.
How are you this morning? And I hear that Gauteng is pretty cold, so jazakallah khair for making the time to be with us.
Alhamdulillah, all well, and it's a pleasure to be with our listeners, and it's a more of a personal game than anything else in conducting the program in terms of the amount of learning that I personally experience throughout compiling and composing the program.
Alhamdulillah, I must say it's a very big learning curve for me, and I'm sure for the listeners as well. So shukran for your time. So we are discussing, I see today, a lot of things that impact on a couple and marriage. So the first thing that we're looking at are the pros and cons of a couple maintaining a joint bank account. That's very, very important.
Yes, I think before I unpack the topic and respond to your question, Deapa, allow me to just highlight the Islamic position regarding maintenance of a home. And I think it's something that we just simply cannot escape. And in discussing the whole issue of maintaining a joint bank account between a couple, we must be careful of not overlooking this ideal Islamic position, which is something that all of us need to be working towards. The Islamic position regarding the maintenance of a marital home is simple and sweet. It is that the responsibility rests with the husband. The male counterpart has the primary duty to see to the financial well-being of a home. So in discussing this whole issue of a joint bank account, we do not want to run the risk of running away or escaping from the duty of the husband to maintain a household. So that is the default position, and this is why, from an Islamic perspective, the wife is not required to make any contribution unless otherwise agreed between the husband and wife. But by default, the wife is not required to be laying out any funds, irrespective of how wealthy she is, towards the maintenance of her home from a financial point of view. So that is the Islamic position. Yes, if the parties agree otherwise, they feel that both of them are working, both of them are in a, maybe even not working, but just both of them have some kind of financial standing and able to contribute towards the maintenance of the home from a financial point of view, then that is a different matter. I think for now what I'll do is I'll just go through three disadvantages of a joint bank account, and then look at three advantages of a joint bank account. Okay. And then we could welcome listeners to make any contribution if they want to, since we have time till the end of the program.
Yes. Well, the listeners can call on 011-854-1548, and I'll give out the WhatsApp number, which is 084-030-9955. You can WhatsApp on that, or you can call us on 011-854-1548, and inshallah, Mufti will try and answer the questions if he can.
Yes. So let's begin with the disadvantages of a joint bank account. And let's begin by saying that the first disadvantage is that the parties contribute towards the joint bank account, but in unequal amounts. This is one of the biggest disadvantages of a joint bank account, because this is where the unfairness starts. And the earlier it starts, the more greater the disadvantage, where one party contributes much more or significantly more than the other party. Now, this is something to be wary of. The ideal way of beginning of the joint bank account is to make sure that the contributions are equal, whether it's going to be from the initial stage or initiating the whole bank account, or throughout the lifetime of maintaining the bank account, okay, on a monthly basis or semi-regular basis, whatever is agreed upon between the parties. To make the same amount of contribution, the equal contribution, is something that should be maintained for the interest of both parties. That's the first disadvantage of a joint bank account. The second disadvantage of a joint bank account is the danger in case of a messy breakup, where the joint bank account is held, and maybe sometimes sometimes some of the rules of the bank or are not taken care of adequately between the husband and wife, such that maybe one party has less rights in terms of controlling that account, you know.
Yes.
In the case of a messy breakup, this kind of thing could be a disadvantage to the parties. So the issue of if things go pear-shaped in the relationship, what do we do with the joint bank account? That's the second disadvantage of a joint bank account. The third is the it's relative, but let's call it the loss of independence, where a party in the couple has made a contribution towards the joint bank account and wants to make some kind of decision regarding money to be spent from that account, but the other party is not in agreement. And let's just for just to ease the reference, or to make the point more clearer, let's just assume that the avenue of spending is kind of arguable whether it's legitimate or not.
Okay.
from a relationship point of view. So it's some extra thing, some luxury item, and one party wants to do it, the other party just doesn't want to do it. So that loss of, let's call it a loss of independence, is something that can become a disadvantage in maintaining that joint bank account. What I have omitted in these three disadvantages is the issue of the Islamic estate, which is also an important aspect, because from an Islamic estate point of view, if either one of those parties pass on, then we need to be very certain regarding what proportion of that bank account belongs to the surviving spouse, because that portion does not go into the estate of the deceased spouse. So we've got to make that distinction, and this is why that equal contribution makes it much more easier to maintain, because we know that exactly X amount belongs to the spouse who is surviving, and the other amount goes to the estate of the deceased spouse. So these are just the three disadvantages of a joint bank account. Before I go into the advantages, maybe I'll allow you to just make your contribution.
Well, you know, I was thinking about it, and a lot of the issues for finance usually comes from the fact that, you know, you spoke about the inequality. And I think that's where a lot of people find that they would, you know, the arguments stem from, or the fact that one person who probably is, you know, and usually it is the female who may not be, you know, earning that much as her male, as her husband. And she then is placed in a very, you know, different situation. And from the way we see the world today, many times women feel that because, as you mentioned when you started, that she is entitled to his financial support, Islamically, she sees that as being, you know, my money being in the account doesn't mean that you could just use it as it is. And I feel that when that happens, if you are deciding on a joint account, it's imperative that they sit down and discuss how that money is going to be used, what that account means for both of them, that kind of thing, to stop all of that haggling that happens after that, because finance is one of the things that actually contributes to many divorces in our society today. So I think it's very important.
Absolutely relevant, because this is why those money meetings are so important, and many of us fall short of these money meetings in a particular household, where we discuss issues of money. And I think before we get to this whole issue of the children, the husband and wife need to be very clear in terms of what is the joint bank account entail. So you mentioned the issue of contribution, you know, equal and unequal amounts, usage of funds from the, those kind of things should be clarified as much as possible, as far as possible, between the parties, so that some harmony is maintained. And then I have been on the side, as we're talking about this, I'm making notes about a separate segment that we could do regarding the whole issue of money management in a particular household between a husband and wife. So those are issues that I'm collating, and inshallah, as soon as the content is ready, we will disseminate it among our listeners, inshallah.
Inshallah. One of the other things that I would like to also say on that very subject is that a lot of the times we find that women in particular don't understand finances all that well. You know, we grow up, I know in many homes, especially amongst Muslim families, you find that women are usually taken care of. You know, your father or your brothers are always there to see to your needs, and many times we find that we are not really au fait with investing and that kind of thing. So when you get into a marriage and you find that you may not understand certain things, so it's good to actually you know, be able to talk or have joint meetings with whoever, like a broker or an agent that from the bank or that you're dealing with. You sit down together with regards to those kinds of things when you have this kind of account, you know, joint anything in a marriage.
Mm-hmm. You know, Akka, just to simplify things, right, is a starting point, together with your contribution there of speaking to someone. I would say that with the advancement of technology, there is so much available in terms of information for ordinary people who are not familiar with financial concepts. So let's just take an example of a lady who wants to equip herself with some basic knowledge of finance, right? Mm-hmm. So you read a newspaper or you read some billboard or something catches your eye and your ear, and you're intrigued by what does this mean, you know. Simply just go to your Sheikh Google and put it in there, and you'll get a simple response in terms of what does that concept entail. So before getting to familiar with someone or even being able to trust someone, which is a huge deficit in this day and age, use technology to your advantage so that you gradually, you'll be surprised how much an individual would equip himself or herself over time by just the simple aspect of using technology to identify and find out about financial concepts and constructs.
No, that's very, very true. I've basically learned a lot from doing exactly what you've just said, you know, just putting something in into Google and then reading up on the subject, and the things I don't understand is what I want to question about.
Yes, most definitely. That's the way to go. I think let me just go on to the advantages.
The advantages.
Because there are some of those advantages which can manage money quite well in a relationship. The first one I want to talk about is this whole issue of convenience, which is linked to what we've just discussed and come off. The whole issue of convenience for everyday use, you know, where the parties have made contributions, both of them know that this account is for our household and it's for our joint usage. So when, let's say example, a typical example of the wife having to go out for grocery shopping and getting some things for the house, she knows that, you know what, this is for us. She doesn't have to do it with some kind of guilt that, you know, I'm using the money and I have to give a receipt and I have to do this and I have to do all record keeping and all of those kind of things. See, there's an element of freedom involved in being able to walk into a supermarket and buy whatever is needed for the household. That level of comfort or certainty that at least there's something there in the event of an emergency, maybe, you know, I can go and make the decision alone because the mandate is given that anything supermarket related, anything for day-to-day household needs is agreed between the parties. So that convenience and freedom is there, which I think is significant in a marital relationship.
Absolutely.
The second important advantage is how, through a joint bank account, it is possible to streamline some of the legal affairs between the husband and wife. What I'm referring to is the issue of, in the event of, say, one of the parties passing on, at least there's a bank account from which the surviving spouse can survive using their own funds. If let's say 50% is the other spouse's, what is left is belonging to the surviving spouse, and the surviving spouse has unrestricted access to some money for a period of time before the estate is wound up. So as opposed to the scenario where the wife is being looked after by her husband, she has no clue regarding even the password to enter into a bank account into a transaction. At least there's some kind of access to some money in the interim period before the estate is wound up or any other arrangements are made to support the widow. I'm just using that example as the surviving spouse, whether the surviving spouse is the widow, because that is the most often occurring one.
Yes.
That's the second. The third and final advantage I want to touch on just for today is that when it comes to money management, two pairs of eyes cannot be compared to one pair of eyes. So when two people are overlooking an account, an expenditure from an account, there's much more scrutiny. So it is likely to be the case that one party will agree with some spending and another party will disagree. But that should not be viewed in negative light. We should take it to, in good spirit that this is being done for the betterment of ourselves, for the betterment of mine and your future, so that we save now the same kind of expenditure and mistake is not repeated again. And then when we don't repeat the mistake, that, that so-called sum that would have been spent is now being utilized for something that is for our betterment and for our improvement. Mm-hmm. So now the two eyes of scrutiny is far better than one eye of scrutiny. And that is one of the advantages of maintaining a joint bank account.
Okay, that's quite a bit of information when one thinks about it, and it's so relevant because we have, you know, a lot of the times the common thing said today is that a lot of couples are looking at their wedding but not at their marriages, and this is a very big part of marriage finance. So I think it's relevant information that young people, especially those going into a marriage and those who've already embarked and are still trying to, you know, sort out finance and that kind of thing, I think it's very relevant for them to listen and maybe take nasihat from that.
Indeed. I think that the point you raise is so important that people are so, we don't look beyond our noses when it comes to serious issues of life, you know, and especially marriage, because it's not only this relationship part, it's also this financial part which needs to be looked at and considered. And this is why it is so important to look at the marriage, not that wedding itself.
Absolutely. Okay, the next one, I think this one's a budgeting between a couple, one ingredient when a couple decides to budget together.
You know, when budgeting together, this is all about managing expectations. Now, let's be honest about it, because when a couple are budgeting together and one party, let's say, is falling short of their responsibility, they just expect that the other party is going to make up, you know. So one party is spending and, you know, maybe let's say spending on friends, some outing and this and that, maybe some gadgets or whatever it is, cosmetics, whatever it is. And the one who is letting out so much is expecting that the other one will be saving, you know. Not realizing that the other one is expecting the same of the spouse who is letting out so much of resources. You know, so it's all about managing expectations in terms of budgeting together as a couple. But I think for now, what I want to suffice on and respond to your question is the single ingredient in managing a budget together is the whole issue or skill of dividing responsibilities. Setting clear, demarcated lines regarding who is responsible for what. And I'm not talking about a relationship where everything is run like an office. I'm not talking about that. I'm just saying identify each other's skills. So let's assume one party is able to organize very well, create spreadsheets and track down money that has been spent. That's the skill of one particular party. The other partner is more steady when it comes to finding maybe, say, flights at a good price or grocery store discounts or maybe finding a good place to stay in if you're going out for a few days, you know. So that's the skill that goes with it. So maybe identify whose duty is it to make the bookings or whose duty is it to maybe track our supermarket spending, you know. If you just identify duties in terms of spending of money or managing money, you will be surprised how much you can achieve in terms of a successful budget process in a particular household. So the key questions are, in dividing responsibilities, what are you good at? What part of our shared finances do you actually enjoy doing? And you take that part. That's the first thing. The second question is, who will be responsible for drawing up maybe a weekly or a monthly budget? And the third aspect is, how can I or your partner support you? How can you as a person in a relationship support the other party in their responsibility? You know. So if you know, example, let's assume the typical case of a husband earning, and he just has no time to go to the supermarket and do things or make any other side arrangements other than his work. So in this case, how could the wife play a part in managing money in that specific example? how could she, what sort of role could she play in terms of the spending of the money that is accrued to the home. So I think to sum it up, I would say that one of the most important ingredients in managing a budget together is the whole issue of dividing responsibilities between the husband and wife.
So in saying all of that, I think the main thing would be that both husband and wife have to really communicate with each other. They have to be able to talk and understand each other's weaknesses and strengths and be able to be open enough to say, you know, like I said, communication is the key.
Yes, definitely. But the whole issue of expectations is any successful budget between husband and wife is about communication. Successful couples that budget successfully are actually couples that communicate.
All right. It's, you know, this is a topic that I think is really relevant, especially in today's world, because you see so many people, you know, with the way the economy of our globally is, it's important that we as married people that sit down and communicate and really understand what their budget can and cannot handle and how they can do it together, because without that, it's just not going to work. You know, it becomes almost like a tug of war, and it becomes, everything collapses because of the non-compliance or not getting on because of money.
Most definitely. I think when there's this healthy communication that you talk about between a husband and wife regarding money, I also foresee great benefit in terms of how those two spouses deal with their children and money. Because
yes.
If the two of them are roughly on the same page regarding the money management, the same a consistent message will flow down to the children. And the children will also be able to learn how to manage money, first of all. And number two is in their day-to-day childhood lives, they will be able to make decisions which are in the best interest of themselves and in the fits within the overall framework of their home, so to say. So these are just words we're using, but I don't want to create an impression that the home must be run like an office and, you know, deadlines and timelines. As casual as it can be, it's fine. But what we need is just some more, as you say, communication between the husband and wife regarding money, so that the kind of message, the consistency is maintained between them, and a consistent message is given out to the children.
Children, absolutely. And I think, you're saying it shouldn't be office-like, but there has to be some sort of structure. Even if it's an informal structure, it has to be there in order for that to work.
Yes. What we cannot deny is that society is evolving. So there was a time where women were left out of financial issues, and it worked at that time. And now in the modern day and age where we live so separated lives from our own siblings and our own children sometimes, it is becoming increasingly crucial for women in a household to be involved in management of money. So that's the important issue and point we need to be deriving from the discussion we are having.
Okay, inshallah. I hope people are actually listening and getting, the gist out of this, because it's really, I just feel it's really important in today's, like you said, in the world today. Okay, so the next topic we're dealing with is the consumption of clothing is revealing a worrying trend and only consumers can make an impact. Tell us exactly what it is that's going on.
You know, the whole topic of sustainability is a buzz in every other aspect of life, consumer life and life in general, right?
Yeah.
But the whole issue of sustainability is being overlooked and ignored regarding the clothing industry. And only consumers can make the impact and the desired effect, the desired change. Allow me to just give you a few statistics here for the benefit of our listeners, right? According to a study done by Greenpeace in 2017, sales of clothing have nearly doubled from 1 trillion in 2002. It's now sitting at, in 2015, it went to $1.8 trillion. So it's doubled from 2002 to 2015, we've had a sales of clothing doubling. It's expected to grow by about $2.1 trillion by 2025, which is not far off. That's one issue. The second one is the average person bought 60% more items in 2015 than in 2002. it's 60% more items being bought, clothing items we're talking about, bought in 2015 than in 2002. So the average rate at which an individual wears a garment before discarding it is just about 36%, which means that people are buying so much, yeah, but hardly ever using the item for its full lifetime. What's worrying is that the environmental harm of this specific practice of consumers is you cannot imagine the kind of damage it is doing in terms of carbon emissions and climate change. So it's amazing, because if you look at it, the fashion industry consumes nearly 80 billion cubic meters of fresh water. It's wow. 80 billion cubic meters of fresh water. It emitted over 1 million tons of CO2 and produced 92 million tons of waste just in producing that clothing. So on the one hand, we've got these harms of this clothing, this fast fashion that is being produced to meet consumer demand.
Mm-hmm.
People are buying more clothing than ever before, but using it less than ever before. And the environmental damage of this specific practice is worrying. I think for now, what I want to do is, before I get your input on the whole issue of the fast pace of the fashion industry, I just want to say that in Sweden, there's a fashion designer,
yeah,
that is involved in the redesigning of old clothing. So mm-hmm. their mission is about redesigning old clothing. So it's a simple process of collecting old clothing and utilizing it to design brand new garments. So this is becoming it's a buzz in a country like Sweden. And for me, as much as the word Islamic are not being used in this practice of the fashion designer, I would say that this is purely Islamic practice that is being done here. So I've seen some of the images of the designs where you have, like, you know, clothing with patches on it. But as much as it sounds despicable to have clothing with a patch on it, it actually looks quite appealing, and it's something that is being tolerated by the market. So the specific fashion designer is reusing about 2.5 tons of textile annually. Reusing 2.5 tons of wasted textile in to design new garments. So there is potential, but I think it's up to consumers.
Well, you know, as Muslim women who wear the abayas, we see how much of that is brought into the country and the cost of it. And the other day I interviewed a brother and we spoke about the halal industry. And if you see what Muslims spend on a regular basis, it's actually mind blowing. And, like you said, you know, we could use, I'm not sure if we have Mufti with us.
Yes, I'm with you.
Oh, you're still there. Okay. We find that there is a lot of wastage. A lot of the times, the abayas we wear, they stitch these days for fashion more than for the function it's actually supposed to serve. So you find that a lot of them are worn for a specific period of time and then given away. And I know a lot of ladies are probably gonna blast me for saying this, but it is waste. It is waste. And sometimes we give it away to others to use, but how often do we know whether this is actually being consistently given to somebody, or is it just being thrown aside? A lot of the times you find that there are other innovative ways that you could use this. I mean, recently, like you've mentioned now, the redesign of old clothes. There's also the, giving your clothes, putting up a little street market where you hang up the clothes after making sure that they are properly, you know, stitched if they've had any tears or whatever. And letting people who can't afford to just come and help themselves to it. I know in Turkey they have the initiative where they take their jackets in winter and hang it up on trees, and anybody who doesn't have one can come and just take it. Nobody is there to say you can't, or the person can try it on. If they don't like it, they can just leave it for someone else. So there are ways that we can save. And I think, you know, when we look at, I'm very passionate about the environment. And I see the damage that's being done on a daily basis. And living on the coast, we see the sea and what's happening there. So obviously, I think that there's much more that we can do with regards to, like you said, redesigning or thinking up ways of which, you know, that we can use it. And I mean, South Africa had a thriving clothing industry that, because of the Chinese market, no longer exists, especially in the Cape. And I think that's where we should be looking at maybe reviving that industry by doing this kind of thing. So I think we could actually, you know, if people out there, young people especially, is, you know, there aren't many jobs, here's a way that they can actually start creating jobs and actually making the market a better place for themselves.
Indeed. I think what appeals to me in your discussion there is the issue of how much of clothing wastage is taking place within the community. And wastage in the sense that we don't take full responsibility from ownership up to the point of the end of that garment, you know. So we just perceive that giving it over to someone, it will be used, you know. Whereas that person may not be using it purely because it doesn't fit their profile or their ordinary acceptable use of garments. So the responsibility is not just while the garment is with you, it's also after it leaves your possession. Try as best as you can to make sure that there's some kind of discretion used in terms of who you give your garments to so that it is optimally utilized and the garment is taken care of even after it leaves your own personal possession. I think what stands out is that the way you dress says something about you as a person. This particular saying has had impact in terms of the lives of the companions of Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, you know. When they dressed with patches and with thorns as buttons, it reflected their personality. And that's why we still learn from their lives. For us as individuals, if we are able to dress according to what our values truly are, should be from an Islamic perspective, it will say something about us as a person itself. So we're living in a world where famous personalities want to wear clothing that has patches and reveals, stand for a cause that is about protecting the environment and making sure that garments, textiles do not harm the environment. How come we are not in the forefront of those kind of initiatives?
Yes. I mean, today you find young people wearing jeans that are ripped. It all looks almost as if there's no material. It's just all ripped. And at, you know, previously someone wearing that was seen as some, you know, they couldn't afford clothing or they picked it up from somewhere because they just didn't have. But today it's a fashion statement. And that comes from, I mean, if you look at, as you've mentioned, people in days gone by wore clothes that they could afford. And if they didn't, they patched it. They did their best. I mean, if you look at my great-grandparents, your great-grandparents, the ladies were taught how to do to actually stitch so that they could cover up a patch and make it look aesthetic, you know, give it aesthetic appeal.
Mm. Potential. It's about potential and about applying ourselves. The operable term is applying ourselves to find solutions for some of the problems that face our community.
All right, we can take a quick break, and inshallah, when we come back, we can carry on with the rest of the show. I think we want to add in a little bit of, you've added in, a new slot to the show.
Inshallah. We can proceed with it, and I'm looking forward to unpacking it, inshallah.
Inshallah. We'll take a break, and we'll be back soon. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Ahlan wa sahlan. You are listening to the Early Sunday Morning Show here on Radio Islam International with me, Anisa Isaac, and my guest for this slot of the show called The Conscious Consumer is Mufti Muhammad Hafiji from the Economics and Finance Desk of the Jamaatul Ulama, South Africa. Mufti, are you still with us?
Still, yeah.
All right, shukran. Well, I said we were adding a new slot to this part of the show, and it's called Measuring Money. Do you want to tell us a little bit about it?
Yes, I think what we want to do in Measuring Money over the next few weeks, maybe for this term, school term, inshallah, is to unpack concepts related to how we as ordinary individuals are advised to measure money. I'm not saying that money is some kind of God godly status. For us as Muslims, we know what money is. It's purely a means to fulfilling our needs. But we live in a world which is modern and is evolving all the time, and concepts regarding money need to be addressed and understood. And therefore, I'm just taking a layman's approach to unpacking a few concepts related to money, because I believe that what we do not measure, we are not managing. That is important to keep in mind. We live in a world where everything is about data capturing, data handling, and forecasting and measuring, developing policy based on information and data which is available to us. So if we are not measuring money, we are probably not managing money that well. And I believe these concepts are important, because if you don't measure what kind of effort you're making on a regular basis, it is very difficult to say whether one is improving over time from a money and financial point of view. So that is basically what measuring money aims to achieve. And I hope that this term-long episode will be of benefit to our listeners who may or may not be familiar with these concepts that are to follow, inshallah.
Inshallah. I think it's a brilliant idea, because a lot, like I was saying earlier, a lot of us don't always understand finance and the terms that come with it. And, you know, so it would be great to have this kind of initiative.
Yes. I'm looking forward to it, and I've got some of it mentioned. And if our listeners have any other concepts that they are not familiar with, I would be willing to look into it and unpack it for others, inshallah.
All right. We can also, if you are wanting to ask any question that's finance related to what we were speaking about, or something that maybe is on your mind, you're welcome to contact us. Mufti will answer if he can during the show. It's 011-854-1548. Or if you want to send a WhatsApp message, the number 084-030-9955, inshallah. So tell us, what's the first episode measuring money? What can we know more about savings, the savings rate in particular?
Yes. But the savings rate is probably one of the most important money metrics, right? The savings rate is not savings. So if a person has got income, let's say X amount of money, say 30,000 rand, earning on a monthly basis, and they save, let's say, 5,000 rand, that is your savings for the month. Right? That is different to what we're talking about today in terms of a savings rate. A savings rate is basically the portion of disposable income that an individual dedicates towards a savings instrument, whether it be an emergency fund or an investment or saving for a short-term goal. So it's separate from savings. Savings rate is basically an amount of disposable income that you set aside towards a savings instrument, like an emergency fund or an investment of some sort.
Yeah.
Basically Sharia compliant. Now, the easiest way to calculate this is by subtracting your monthly expenses from your take-home pay. Okay, so step one is to subtract your monthly expenses from your take-home pay, which is the pay you get after deducting tax. Yeah. Right? You take that answer and divide it by your income. So if you're earning 30,000 rand and you're spending 25, you make that deduction, step number one, and then you divide by your income, which is 30,000, and to get a percentage, you simply multiply your final answer by 100. So if I repeat the example, you've got 30,000 rand of income, you spend 25,000 from there, and you left with 5,000. You divide that 5 by your 30,000, which is your total income, and you multiply by 100. Now this will give you, in the example I've given, 16.66% of a wage, which is given towards a savings instrument. So it's not just 16% of your income that you're going to put under a mattress or keep in a bank account. You are going to use this 16.66%. The savings rate is going to be used towards a long-term goal or an investment or something towards your retirement of some sort. So this is what we call, or what we call is the savings rate. Now, the reason why it is important to manage or know about the savings rate is because it develops this habit of thinking towards the future and not permanently being fixated on the present only. is one benefit of implementing the calculation of one's savings rate on a monthly basis. And together with this, it also has the ability to bring about self-restraint, self-control, some discipline in terms of managing one's money. So it doesn't mean that if a person is earning a lower income, they cannot have a savings rate. Anyone can have a savings rate. You just have to take the balance of your income after all your expenditure, divide it by your income, and multiply by 100. This gives you your savings rate. And as I mentioned, and I want to repeat for another time, hopefully the last time, that this savings rate is not just ordinary savings that is going to be sitting idle. It's going to be utilized towards saving to beat inflation and put towards an instrument that can benefit a person in the longer term. So this is why the savings rate is important. And I must mention that in a country like South Africa, we are referred to as a consumption-driven country. There's a huge meaning to what I'm saying in economic terms, in the sense that the consumption of goods and services actually drives the economy itself. But in a country that is consumption-driven, by and large, the savings rate of individuals is quite low. Whereas in countries like China, Taiwan, those countries where you find that they are not consumption driven, they are more manufacturing driven, more on that line of things. In that case, savings rate is much more higher. So if a person does have a low savings rate, it should not be cause for concern. For now, I would be satisfied if someone just does the calculation and makes sure they're conscious of what the savings rate is all about, and not so much be concerned with how much are you actually, how high is your savings rate.
Okay. Just on that subject that you've mentioned now, that South Africa is more of a country of consumption rather than of savings, recently, I think it was a day or two, I heard on the news that most people in South Africa spend the bulk of their salary to pay off debt.
Correct.
So that in itself is scary, but more importantly, when a country as South Africa is more consumption-based than manufacturing, how does that affect our economy and our pockets at the end of the day?
It affects us purely because of the component of savings, because so much is being dedicated towards servicing debt, and according to statistics, it's about 75% of average disposable income that is utilized for servicing of debt. You find that when a nation is consumption driven, it becomes less competitive on the international scale, purely because of its dependency on the goods and services of others. So you become more exposed to maybe interest rate fluctuations because you have to purchase so much, you have to expand so much to obtain goods and services that if interest rates increase or go higher, you have to pay more for your goods and services, which you are highly reliant and dependent on. So you become, if I could simply put it and respond to your question, but it would be that you lose your sovereignty, your freedom is lost. By being consumption driven, because anything that someone else decides dictates your behavior and your movements.
Okay, because the other thing I wanted to bring up was I also happened to be reading something and what caught me were the words. It's a banker who was speaking to a group of people, and he said that the best way to rule, to take somebody's freedom away from them or to make them indebted to you is to get them to become indebted. In other words, to get them to start spending so much of money that they are unable to save, and that they will rely on you for their constant financial situation. And that's exactly what you've just said to us. And I don't think people really understand that, because, as armchair critics, we'll sit and we'll say that the economy is bad because of this or because of that. But sometimes we don't realize that we actually add to that.
Yes, most definitely. We are part of the problem by not watching or keeping a tab on our own consumption behavior. We actually lose our own freedom and trade our own sovereignty in view of the comfort that we want to enjoy in our day-to-day lives.
Well, we've come to the end of the show. This is really an interesting subject, and it's really your shows have been really, I can say as somebody listening in and interacting with you, that I've learned so much from it, and I hope that many of our listeners out there are finding the same. If you want to find or haven't heard the full the slot, and you want to go back and listen, it's the podcasts are uploaded to our website usually on Monday morning, so inshallah you're welcome to go and listen and download them from there. And Mufti, Jazakallah Khair for your time, and we'll speak to you again next week, inshallah.
It's been a pleasure. Jazakallah Khair for having me, and I look forward to next week's segment, inshallah.
Ameen. So do I. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Well, we've come to the end of another early morning Sunday show, and I think this has been really, I totally enjoy these conscious consumer. For me, finance has never been a part of my life other than the fact that I'm a consumer and I spend a lot of money. But alhamdulillah, you learn something every day, and this has been one of those slots of shows that I can say that I've basically learned so much. And I must say, may Allah reward Mufti for giving us the opportunity to be able to learn like this. So for me, Jazakallah Khair, have a good rest of Sunday, and inshallah I'll be back tomorrow. So assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu.